Dr. Luther, and ladies and gentlemen. When Professor Obermann indicated at the outset of his remarks that his presentation wished to emulate the format and the style that we would like to associate with Martin Luther, my mind quickly pondered as to the implications of that paradigm for the left wing of the Reformation. And I confess to you that I quickly dismayed, since I recalled the sermon disruptions and disturbances in the villages outside Zurich which accompanied the rise of Anabaptism. And I also recalled the seven Anabaptists who ran naked through the, to be sure, with biblical allusions, who ran naked through the streets of Amsterdam. And I concluded that those styles would be no more acceptable today than they were in the 16th century, even though I must confess that I was intermittently tempted to speak up during Professor Obermann's presentation. But then then there is Thomas Münzer, that fiery left-wing reformer, and lo and behold, it came to mind that from all contemporary accounts, his famous sermon on Daniel, which delineated the most striking his most striking vision of reform, was undoubtedly read from a manuscript, and therefore bored his hearers, namely the rulers of Saxony, to no end. So Martin Luther and the left wing of the Reformation. A little more than half a century ago, in the setting of another Luther celebration or jubilee, Karl Hull, without whom I guess we cannot, Karl Hull delivered his famous essay on Luther und die Schwärme. And that essay has cast its provocative long shadow over Luther and Reformation research ever since. Of course, neither Hull's argument nor his conceptualization was exactly new. They were vintage Martin Luther. Hull argued that a theological kinship characterized the motley group of reformers alongside Luther, from Andreas Karlstadt and Thomas Münzer to the Anabaptists and even Huldrych Zwingli. Hull acknowledged Münzer, whom he described as being incisively influenced by medieval mysticism, as the most creative spirit of the dissenters or radicals of the Reformation. Now, I take my assignment this morning to be one of offering reflections on the topic that Karl Hull raised, perhaps suggesting in the place of my own enigmatic title a more tantalizing one, namely Karl Hull Revisited. Now, Hull, as most of us know, Hull's essay was a pointed response to what he viewed to be the overly idealized picture of Reformation radicals that had been drawn by Ernst Troeltsch, who had argued, all too abstractly in Hull's view, that differentiation should be made among those whom whom Luther had so disparagingly and generically called a Schwärme. Hull's fundamental point was to both to raise the question and to posit the thesis of the generic relatedness of all 16th century continental reformers other than those associated with John Calvin. But Hull's thesis was not proved not uniformly persuasive. Most scholars of the Reformation have tended to follow Trelchus, differentiating an indeed more positive perspective. Indeed, as one views the course of Reformation studies during the past half century, the changed role of the Schwelme is assuredly the most dramatic ingredient. No longer viewed as a fringe phenomenon of insignificant size and dubious theology, the Schwelme became a major part of the Reformation. In an American Reformation scholarship, at any rate, the past two generations were characterized by an ever-increasing enthusiasm for the left wing or the radical Reformation, specifically, of course, for the Anabaptists. Harold S. Bender and the scholars who filled the pages of the Mennonite Quarterly Review in the 1940s and 1950s delineated indefatigably the Anabaptist vision of discipleship, often, let it be said, with little subtlety or decorum, identifying the Anabaptists, a certain strand among them, that is, as the most authentic disciples of the New Testament in the 16th century. And even church historians outside the Mennonite and so-called free church tradition were equally sympathetic toward a positive perspective of the 16th century spectrum of Protestant continental descent. Now, the historical sitz im Leben of this left wing, so-called, was rather clearly described. As regards the Anabaptists, the argument was that, fully followers of the major reformers, they fulfilled, from their Zurich origins to their settling down in non-resistant, biblically-oriented believers' congregations in Holland, South Germany, and Moravia, the early aspirations of the reformers. They were, so the argument ran, in fact, the most consistent, if not most insightful, of reformers of the 16th century. And what needs to be reiterated is that such research proved to be the most dynamic and most exciting field of Reformation scholarship during the past generation. Even the vocabulary changed. Schwärme, the English term enthusiasts, pales over the German imagery of what Gordon Rupp once defined as too many bees chasing too few bonnets. Schwärme became a no-no, tolerated only from the lips and pens of Orthodox Lutherans and immature scholars. Wiedertäufer became simple Täufer. Roland Bainton gave us the left wing, and thereby my title, and George H. Williams offered us the radical Reformation. Neither term, I submit, was conceptually as clear as seemed at first glance, and Williams, moreover, encumbered his classification scheme with undue typological complexity. Still, it must be recorded that radical Reformation, rather than left wing, is nowadays the accepted coinage of the realm, with only occasional lapses such as that of my title. Demurs are voiced by Marxist scholars of the early 16th century or early bourgeois revolution who have proffered a societal definition of the meaning of radical reform or radical reformation and who have drawn a distinction between moderate and radical reformers in the early 16th century on the basis of the restriction of reform to theology and church polity, namely moderate reformers, or the definition, or rather the expansion of reform to all of society, and that then, according to the Marxist definition, of course, takes us to Münzer and is defined as radical. Then there are those of an unreconstructed mind, such as your present servant, who are persuaded that all 16th century reformers meant to go back to the roots, which were defined differently by different reformers. And to draw elaborate conclusions from an alleged difference or divergence between the concept of reformation on the one hand and restitution on the other, or to play out the early church against the New Testament, in my mind, simplifies early 16th century reality. Moreover, the distinction between a radical and a magisterial reformation, the one, the former free, the other, the latter, dependent on governmental involvement in the pursuit of reform, surely describes the eventual outcome, but not the origins of the movements of dissent. By which I mean to say that I, for my part, find myself most comfortable with a nomenclature that is free from contestable or normative notions and is as descriptive as possible. Therefore, neither left wing nor radical reformation, terms which beg to be explained, but rather Anabaptist and or anti-Trinitarian movements of reform appears appropriate. Since Luther and Reformation scholarship tend to derive their inspiration, as well as frequently their vocabulary from Germany, means that the crispness afforded, lo and behold, by the English scene, where we have easily accessible and meaningful labels such as separatists or dissenters, Gordon Rupp, as you may know, once even suggested, not altogether successfully, that we should talk about Reformation Puritans when talking about the 1520s. At any rate, that what I called the crispness afforded by the English scene is neither appropriated nor fully appreciated. Now, having so stated the case, I need to ask the indulgence of this audience if, despite my stated conceptual predilection, either fuzziness of thought or felicity of phrase will indeed introduce a lack of consistency and an intriguing interchange of terms into my presentation. Now, Trilch Hall and recent left-wing scholarship, however different in their conceptualization and however different in their value judgments, joined, I believe, in a common premise. And that was, they imposed a theological point of view and specific theological, and I make this a case even with Trilch, and specific theological ideal types onto historical reality. But the problem was and is that that reality was exceedingly diverse. One cannot read far in the sources without recognizing that the early Reformation stage was exceedingly crowded with what, to use the phrase from the Book of Common Prayer, we call the all sorts and conditions of men. Not only attractive and theologically coherent figures, but also, and I say it stridently, dreamers and crackpots and fantasts who propounded bizarre notions which frequently, so the record shows, made sense only to themselves. David Joris had the qualities of Shakespeare's Falstaff. Melchior Hoffman satisfied himself that he had deciphered the mystery of what he had called the figure and brooded endlessly over it. Augustine Bader proclaimed himself king of the universe. The 16th century was, as we were recently reassured by Professor Obermann, an apocalyptic age, and there were many who claimed that they had mastered the arithmetic of the last days. Now, all of this speaks either to the character of the time or, in a way yet to be defined and explored, speaks to the impact of Luther, to a richness of views and persons and movements that was the movement of reform in the early 1520s. And that, I submit, is the important point. The somewhat haughty term polygenesis, nowadays used to describe Anabaptist origins, reflects, I think appropriately, the recognition that the religious scene was indeed heterogeneous. There were no Lutherans, only Martinians, vaguely committed to the pursuit of the word and to reform, whatever either meant. But it is clear that in this stunningly, diverse, or if you please, rich scene, a certain motley can be grouped and lumped together as having been characterized by their viewing themselves as a distinct alternative to the Lutheran and also to the Zwinglian Reformation. They can be, let me repeat this, identified as being characterized by their viewing themselves as distinct alternatives to the Lutheran and the Zwinglian Reformation, seeking, as we have been told, to reform the Reformation. If their sundry theologies can be coherently reconstructed, or if, and I am obviously, or maybe not so obviously, subtly commenting on left-wing scholarship of the past two generations, if every one of these figures was a diamond in the rough, so to speak, or a profound commentator on the Christian faith, is an altogether different matter. No doubt, the ceaseless typologizing and reflections about patterns means that historians, haunted perhaps by theologians, have a deep yearning to introduce order into diversity or chaos. And the problem lies both in the enticement to make normative theological pronouncements and in the diversity of the scene of the 1520s, of which I've already spoken. Were one in this richness and in this diversity, one may posit closeness to Luther in one respect. I'm thinking here of Jim Steyer's argument that as regards the teaching of the two kingdoms, the Anabaptists were very close to Luther. Or one can posit distance, and I'm thinking here of Kenneth Davis' argument concerning the influence of the Franciscan tertiaries on Anabaptist soteriology, depending, in other words, on the specific issue selected. Now, of late, last decade or so, a revisionist stance has begun to appear among the scholars of the Radical Reformation and has begun to position itself as a new orthodoxy. There is a growing and indeed overwhelming sense that the Anabaptist vision of the past generation was too idealized, too pure, and too abstract. Accordingly, the current perspective sees the numerical dimension of the Anabaptist movement as modest, the theological indebtedness to the medieval tradition alongside to that of Luther and Zwingli is formidable, the theological characteristics of Anabaptism and the Radical Reformation as bewilderingly diverse, and the Radicals by no means the consistent perfectors of inconsistent or haphazard reformers. Now I submit to you that it is difficult not to exaggerate the impact of this current perspective. And I say this because I find it to be the case not so much on account of specific findings and specific insights which this recent scholarship has produced for us, but rather, and I need to be most emphatic about this, on account of a new and fundamentally different vantage point. Because if I see it correctly, the new perspective is no longer theological nor theologically normative. It is plain and simple historical. We therefore have a view of Reformation happenings and developments which stresses for the Anabaptists, no less than for Karlstadt and Thomas Münzer, the profound interrelatedness of political, social, economic, and theological forces. And if that vantage point is assumed, it means, for example, that a sharp contrast can indeed be drawn between the initial thrust of the Anabaptist movement in Switzerland and its more mature manifestation, say, 10 years later, or even earlier than say, at Schleitheim in 1527. Chabitzes, the East German, or should I say, Marxist historian's notion of the continuity between Münzer, the Peasants' War, and Anabaptism in Central Germany has been sustained, I believe, in recent scholarship. Now, this new orthodoxy is still in a state of flux. Perhaps it is no orthodoxy at all. And one must note that, as an important characteristic, that no real dialogue between the more recent and the older school of interpretation of Anabaptism appears to be taking place, which may well be in large measure for the reason that the distinction between new and old is also a distinction between young and old. That is to say, we're dealing with a matter of a generational issue of scholarship. Now, to me, the issue, and I am reiterating what I said somewhat abstractly a moment ago, the issue seems to lie not so much in the question of monogenesis or polygenesis, of the rise of Anabaptism, of Zollikon or Zurich or Schleitheim, or of Luther or Münzer as mentors of the Anabaptists. Nor does the issue seem to me to lie that Hull knew Luther but did not know the Anabaptists, while Harold Bender or Robert Friedman knew the Anabaptists but did not know Luther or Zwingli. Rather, the issue is that Bender's or Littell's or Blunkes or Yoder's predilection for the Anabaptists, or the left wing, speaking about Littell, was every bit as theologically normative, or, if you please, doctrinaire, as Hull's had been for Luther, and that several of the important and insightful revisionist scholars of the left wing are secular rather than church historians. I myself am convinced that the proper picture of Anabaptism that should be emerging will posit greater diversity and heterogeneity at the beginning, both in terms of influences and historical emergence, but that we will be eventually driven back to the conclusion that Anabaptism as a phenomenon germane to the entire age or period of the Reformation was indeed that which earlier research associated with Bender and others had indicated, because I think the strictures, to just cite one illustration, the strictures that one can and must address against the methodology that one finds, for example, in C.P. Claassen are still, and his social history of the Anabaptism still stand. Now, I am concentrating on Luther and his relationship to a left-wing defined foremostly in terms of Karlstadt, Münster, and above all, as already should be clear, the Anabaptists. As I do that, I need to be explicit that I do not mean to put the far more extensive reality into a straitjacket. And I'm fully aware, as we all are, that there were other exponents of the Radical Reformation. But I note, at the very outset of now turning my attention to Luther, that it was assuredly Luther's eminent characteristic that he treated most of the radical reformers with a great deal of silence and possibly contempt. And Münzer and Karlstadt and the Anabaptists in that order are the exception. Against them, but now more precisely about the former two, Luther had many words to say, vehement, derogatory, and one suspects that once the initial torrent of words had issued forth, he concluded that all that needed to be said about these Schwärme had indeed been said. So that therefore, looking at Luther's relationship to the left wing in its entirety, one finds, I submit, that his pronouncements are occasional utterances, and we are hard-pressed indeed to draw a coherent or at least fully descriptive picture of the left wing from his words. And I suspect that it is that for that very reason that no monographic treatment of our topic exists. Now, the initial point of convergence between Luther and the left wing pertains to the question of origins, a question which has two sides. As regards Luther, we need to ask if he is to be seen as the mentor, however unwittingly, of Reformation descent. And as regards the radicals, we need to ask if they truly understood Luther. Now I submit that a distinction needs to be drawn between the role of Karlstadt and Münzer on the one hand and the emergence of the Anabaptists, however defined, on the other. Karlstadt and Münzer, to say it simply, sought to posit theological alternatives to Luther. The rise of Anabaptism, on the other hand, is nowadays seen as the outgrowth of a convergence of theological as well as non-theological factors. And in that context, then, it was the late Münzer who demonstrably exerted his influence on the incipient Anabaptists, who started, so to speak, where Münzer ended, namely a vision of reform that entailed the change of the existing social order. It is intriguing to observe how the early Münzer and the early Anabaptists, each representing different perspectives, to be sure, dealt with the frustration they encountered when they were thwarted. The one turning into a social revolutionary, the other into pacifists. But I repeat again, all of them are best seen as the result of neither a consistent culmination nor a fatal misunderstanding of Luther. The picture is more complex. The heavy presence of a popularized medieval mystic tradition, the Theologia Deutsch in Tauler and even Eckhart, is clear enough. Erasmus is less prominent, at least in current scholarship, but I think still a present. Clearly expressed the Anabaptists' self-conscious notion of completing the reform forcefully begun by Luther and the other reformers, but only haphazardly completed and continued and completed. Thus, the Hutterite Chronicle of later years undoubtedly echoed widespread sentiment when it remarked that Luther had broken the Pope's pitcher but had kept the pieces in his hands. the sense of completing what was left incomplete, rather than a sense of offering an alternative, pervades the writings of the Anabaptists. Now, the specific issues were two, the nature of justification and the nature of the church. On the issue of justification, Luther was rigid. He was, I submit, somewhat more open as regards the matter of the church. But it seems clear, and I will touch on it only in passing, though I must say it is a controversial matter. It seems clear that by seeking to improve on Luther's soteriology, the Anabaptists found themselves virtually back where Luther had started. Now, I make the point, not to be misunderstood, not to posit Luther as the linchpin of all 16th century reform, but to underscore the theological complexity we're dealing with, the complexity of the time, the myriad of forces and influences and outcomes, and to suggest that outcomes, at any rate, did not always conform to intentions. And in that sense, narrowly defined, Luther's charge that the Schwärmer were the purveyors of a new work righteousness had the reality as well as the ring of truth. And it must, of course, also be said, in order to make sure the circle is completed, that Luther never accepted the radicals' notion, to the extent to which, as I said earlier, he really commented on it, accepted the notion that anything had been left incomplete. It would seem that Luther was persuaded that his encounters with Karlstadt and with Münzer had exhausted the basic lines of divergence. So other than, and I'm speaking now specifically about soteriology, other than a few stereotypes such as disparaging remarks about wolves in sheep's clothing and such, Luther has very, very little to say about Anabaptist soteriology or even the Anabaptist view of the Christian community or the church. Moreover, the record shows that he was little troubled by the paucity of information he possessed. Persuaded, one presumes, that the rich history of heretical movements in the past history of the church made their contemporary expressions rather like, and here I am doing not body language but figure of speech, rather like stale beer. Now, as regards Luther's theological stance toward the Anabaptists, the single issue was baptism. His most extensive tract came in 1528, was entitled Concerning Rebaptism, written for two pastors. The identity of the two men of the cloth whom Luther addressed is as enigmatic as are the sources for Luther's understanding of the Anabaptist teaching. Luther acknowledged, honest as he always was, that he did not know enough about their teaching, but almost immediately Balthasar Hubmaier, the eminent Anabaptist theologian, was to chide him, not so much for his honesty than for his ignorance. The issue, of course, was the baptism of infants. Against the Anabaptist challenge, Luther, I think foremostly, was overwhelmed by the reality of the centuries of tradition, the centuries of tradition of the baptism of infants. And at the same time, he advanced a concept of the sacrament which, while ultimately contingent on the recipient's faith, categorically posited the priority of divine action. Adult baptism, and Professor Obermann touched on it in his presentation, adult baptism was too subjective. One could never be certain if one's faith was authentic. The human condition, after all, was one of doubt. One could be, Luther said, baptized 100 times upon one's presumed faith and still be uncertain as to whether true faith had indeed been present. Moreover, to complicate matters further, those who administered adult or believer's baptism could never be certain of the faith of those whom they baptized. Luther acknowledged, as we know, that in the sacrament of baptism, faith was the indispensable ingredient salvatory for the recipient. Yet Luther chided the Anabaptists for failing to understand that and define that faith as a gift of God, which must not be confused with human perceptions of faith. It does not matter in the sacrament, Luther said, if the infant has faith, because everything is focused on God's work, word, and commandment. If, Luther said, the word, and I quote, the word is with the water, baptism is right, even if no faith is added. Faith does not make baptism, but receives it. His notion of the scriptural justification of infant baptism, combined, I repeat, with the import of centuries of practice, determined his position. But it hinged, as regards believers' baptism, on his categorical premise of the permanent uncertainty of one's faith. There are no absolute signs that faith is present, certainly not the voluntary request to be baptized. Now Luther's stance, and it is well familiar, so I can be brief and even omit his notion of the fetus infantium, the faith of infants. Luther's stance was predicated, I think, also on his understanding of the situation in his own time. Not a missionary, not a pagan situation, but rather one where each infant born was embedded into an environment in which the Christian gospel was constantly proclaimed. All this is well and widely known, of course, but the point is to be made that Luther seemed little troubled by the Anabaptist challenge. The early church had taken the correct position, and that was it. Now, having said what I said, I need to add a paragraph which says that in all of this, Luther's direct influence concerning the Anabaptist doctrine or theology of baptism should not be underestimated. Because there is a line of thought in the early Luther which suggests indeed that baptism should be seen as a covenant where man surrenders to suppress, to kill the old Adam, while God promises not to reckon sin which persists even after baptism. And the Christian, so Luther argued, testifies through baptism to a willingness to die unto sin and to rise in Christ. Now it is this thought, I submit, which underlies in a very dramatic way the baptismal theology which one finds in the famous letter written by Conrad Grebel and his associates to Münzer. So that, again, in an intriguing way, the conclusion is to be drawn that influences do exist, even though it is equally clear that other influences, and they then fall again into the heading of what Professor Obermann has reminded us about the impact of the richness of the medieval scene, other influences which moved Anabaptist theologizing eventually into a quite different direction. Just to say this, Hans Hutz, baptismal theology, which in a way he had received from Thomas Münzer, and then, as I said, one draws lines from Münzer to Zurich, who clearly saw the divine promise that is manifested in baptism as a promise, not as the divine promise not to forsake man and woman in suffering. Now this takes me to the second issue, that of word and spirit. It surely was Luther's significance to have enunciated a new vision of biblical theology. The appeal was to the Word, and it is an indication of Luther's pivotal significance that this Word was assuredly central for everyone in the 1520s, including his antagonists Karlstadt and Münzer and the Anabaptists. The Word dominated, I submit, the agenda of the first years of the Reformation. And I think it can be shown that even Münzer, profoundly influenced as he was by Taulerian mysticism, never surrendered his deep appreciation for the Word, as indeed, and once one thinks, reads him, it becomes very clear, his rigid biblicism forms an intriguing element in his thought. Still, it was in the area of authority that the clash between Luther and the radicals occurred, and by implication proved to be most pronounced. It goes without saying that the early Reformation confrontation between tradition and the Word was bound to turn into a confrontation between the Word and the Spirit as soon as it had been shown that the Word lacked definitive precision, but rather was, like Luther was disposed to say about natural reason, a waxen nose that could be twisted at will. It was the reading of the Word in the proper spirit that the radicals threw against Luther. And the intensity of the rivalry produced ever more extremist statements, so that indeed by the middle of the 1520s, Luther and his dissenting disciples were poles apart. An extreme spiritualism that disavowed the written word on the one hand and a biblical literalism on the other. But there is no doubt but that all of the major dissenters imbibed the heavy wine of daring statements about the Spirit, statements that Luther would never have made. But it is equally clear, I submit, that most, not all, that most of them sobered precisely to that balance which had been the common consensus at the outset of the controversy. The point to be made, I believe, is that the emergence of the left wing was deeply troublesome to Luther. After all, I think he was wise enough to be cognizant of the timeless argument formulated by Bossuet 100 years later that truth is one and the many cannot be truth. And the very multiplicity of options and opinions of reform denied the notion that the church, the one true Catholic Church, even though it had been declared to be invisible, had in fact been reformed and thus restored. Luther, I think, was aware of this for the problem caused by this reality, because he read the Catholic polemicists of his time who anticipated Bossuet no less than we do. One may offer the observation that Luther's relationship to the left wing, characterized by the fact that theological differences took a secondary place, the real issue lay someplace else. And that is that the left wing put forward a fundamental challenge to Luther's notion of authority. The dissenters readily concurred that the church was not necessary as authority, since the Word of God was plain and simple in its message. Luther had made the case against the authority of the church and against human traditions with surprising as well as dramatic ease, even as he had made the case for the Word of God. But it soon disintegrated. It disintegrated not so much on account of those who pursued their theological or biblical emphases or idiosyncrasies by a tacit assumption of concurrence with Luther, or by dissenting only in minor respects, but rather on account of the two men who openly, defiantly, and angrily disagreed with him, Karlstadt and Luther. Luther rose to the task with the full range of emotions and learning and gift of language. No matter that Karlstadt exhibited a heavy dose of pedantic tedium or Münzer intermingled literary brilliance with esoteric reflection, Luther saw them as mortal foes. In the confrontation followed the classic pattern. The opponent's statements were driven to the extreme, which compliment was promptly repaid in kind, and thereby, as I've already noted, disagreements widened dramatically. Moreover, Luther argued that his opponents lacked goodwill and honesty and openness. There is a letter from Karl Hohl in which Hohl concedes that personal jealousy, lo and behold, informed, Hohl said, a great deal of Luther's vehemence, a welcome reminder from a staunch partisan that the reformers of the 16th century were prone to human weaknesses. Luther was irritated that some of his fellow reformers, rather like the Catholics, espoused divergent interpretations of Scripture. But the heart of the matter was something else, namely Luther's premise that the word was clear and self-evident and simple in its meaning, so that one could indeed dispense with external authority of church manifest in pope and council. And that premise was shattered. And this takes me then to the final and perhaps touchiest point of all, the legal pursuit and persecution of the dissenters by the authorities, both ecclesiastical and political. For the Reformation radicals, there was no room in the inn. They were persecuted, despite the alleged pluralistic society of which we heard earlier, they were persecuted with uncanny harmony by Catholics and Lutherans alike. This harmony is important in that it makes Luther, to the extent to which he played a role, very much part of a larger historical setting. Now, 16th century statistics, as we all know, are notoriously unreliable, and the martyrologies of the time which tell us about the persecution are hagiographies allowing sundry interpretations. But be that as it may, and despite the fact that the execution of Anabaptists and other radicals virtually subsided after 1539, there is no doubt but that the public profession of Anabaptist and radical tenets entailed the risk of life or limb. And accordingly, we must ask about that configuration of issues that pertain to the role of Luther. Because while the keepers of the jails and the judges and the executioners were drawn from the body politic, the ideology came from the theologians. We recall that one of the 41 propositions for Luther was censured was that to burn heretics is against the will of the Holy Spirit. And indeed, Luther's initial stance was clear, emphatic, and unequivocal. His own neck was at stake, the case being made by Luther and his fellows against the Catholic establishment. A few years later, and one has to say it the way one sees it, the tables turned and dissent came now from within the ranks. Now, Luther always retained the fundamental conviction that theological dissent, being a matter of an individual's inward being, should not be suppressed or persecuted. Such theological consistency, however, proved to be of little existential comfort to the radicals, who promptly discovered that the jailers and the judges and the executioners proffered a new argument, namely, the charge of blasphemy, sedition, and insurrection. In Luther's letter to the rulers of Saxony concerning the rebellious spirit, he drew the distinction between public sedition and heretical teaching. The tracts dealt only with the former. The latter, heretical teaching, that is, was none of the ruler's business. He said, famous words, "Let them preach freely and vigorously, however they can and against anyone they wish. Sects and separation must exist, and the word of God must go to war and fight. Let the minds and the souls clash and fight with each other. If some are so led astray, let it be." That is what happens in war and conflict. And earlier Luther had asserted heresy, and I quote him, "can never be resisted with fire." In his 1528 tract concerning rebaptism, Luther reflected that the punishment of hell was altogether sufficient for the heretics. There was no need to execute them to boot. Now in the 1530s, then, Luther made a different point. Government had an obligation to employ the sharpest measures against the refusal of civic obligation. And in addition, the addition is crucial, the government had the right to take the sharpest measures against Anabaptist tenets of infant baptism and original sin. Public blasphemy must be resisted and punished. Heretics should be condemned even without due process and trial. Now, one may argue that, this comes from 1536, one may argue that just a few months earlier, the dramatic events in the city of Münster had seemingly vindicated the assertion, as had, of course, earlier the argument ran the Münster and the Peasants' War of 24 and 25, that theological deviation inescapably led to insurrection. There was a domino theory to heresy or blasphemy when publicly expressed. No matter how it began, it had to end in the disruption of law and order. Then I submit, as now, eighth domino theory combines conceptual persuasiveness with empirical inconclusiveness. The fact of the matter, I think, is that the Luther of 1536 is quite a few kilometers removed from the Luther of 1524. Or to say it differently, while Luther retained his earlier conceptual frame of reference, the conclusions became different. In 1536, Luther insisted that public proclamation of heresy inescapably leads to political disorder, and in his exposition of the 82nd Psalm, he was quite aware of the argument that he had contradicted himself. Now, I've called this later position complex because its stress on the category of public blasphemy rendered inoperative, I think, his own prior premise. Because there was no way that the repudiation of infant baptism or the advocacy of believers' baptism could be sustained without empirical consequences. And moreover, the extensive Täuferakten interrogations clearly indicate that a large variety of theological loci were made the substance of the objective of governmental concern. So Luther's concession pertained merely and exclusively to what somebody thought. And as soon as that thought was translated into words, say in an interrogation, or words were translated into deeds, or in the case of infant baptism, into non-deeds, the secular authorities were to step in. It is clear, let it be said, that the Anabaptist repudiation of full civic responsibility entailed fateful consequences for 16th century society, consequences which were only artificially obscured by the modesty of the movement, because if society truly was an order of creation, left-wing dissent in terms of participation was not acceptable. In the clash, I conclude, in the clash between Luther and the radicals, there surfaced, alongside the issues that I've mentioned, another broad spectrum of matters that were strikingly timeless. They ranged from all the way from the alternative of seeking to effect change from within or from without, of evolutionary versus revolutionary change, of the role of governmental authority in religious matters, of the role of economics and politics in the shaping of the formulations of the Christian faith, of the relationship of the Christian faith to the social order, and of the function of religion for the cohesiveness of society. And it is surely not for nothing that Karlstadt's very first indictment of Luther's mode and strategy of reform had an identical title as a Puritan tract of the closing years of the century, namely, to use the translation, "If One Should Tarry." And it is this very timeliness that carries us from the 16th century to the 20th. And in an intriguing way, I submit, demonstrates that the fundamental themes of Christian living vary little. Luther and the left wing formulated diverging alternatives. Luther's contribution was that he served as the catalyst which aided in the emergence and formation of these alternatives. His contribution, moreover, was that by his biting repudiation of his antagonists, he helped to bring these alternatives more sharply into focus. His failure, in turn, was his inability to appreciate, in the long run, that is, the biblical themes that were propounded by the radicals and his own recourse to timely yet regrettable means of suppression. This audience full well knows that the question who was right can only be answered by the biblical or the systematic theologian. But this audience also knows, or at any rate, needs to be only fleetingly reminded, that today we are wont to see these diverging alternatives as richness, and that this richness is what constitutes at once the splendid legacy for Christian existence in the closing years of the 20th century, and I thank you.